From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, writer Siobhan Fallon. Her new collection of short stories, You Know When the Men Are Gone, explores the tensions and strain of war on soldiers and the families they leave behind. Fallon's husband has been deployed 3 times, and she says it never gets any easier, especially when he comes home.
It's definitely a tremendous readjustment when your soldier leaves, and it's almost as big of a readjustment when he returns, because after a year, you've actually finally figured out how to be independent.
And we talk with Australian actress Jackie Weaver and director Michael Michaud about the gritty crime drama Animal Kingdom, which takes you inside a Melbourne crime family in decline. And Ken Tucker reviews the new album from The Decembrists. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been fought in an age of embedded reporters, soldiers' blogs, and YouTube videos from overseas and the home front. But our first guest, Siobhan Fallon, employs the traditional low-tech form of short fiction to describe the lives of soldiers and especially their families. Fallon is a military wife, and her new book is based largely on the experiences of Army families in Fort Hood, Texas. When soldiers leave on a deployment, she writes, their spouses somehow manage. They improvise. They take the strangeness and make it normal. In her stories, wives have to deal with oil changes and home repairs, as well as loneliness, the crises of adolescent kids, and sometimes infidelity and even death. Siobhan Fallon is the wife of an Army major who earned her Master's of Fine Arts in Creative Writing at the New School in New York City. She'll soon be leaving for Jordan, where her husband will be stationed. I spoke to her about her book called You Know When the Men Are Gone. Well, Siobhan Fallon, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell us some of the changes in sight, sound, and routine at the base that tells you when the men are gone.
It's pretty obvious right from the first moment that the soldiers deploy because, one, there are so many to begin with. So as soon as the brigades start rotating out, you have this eerie sort of quietness. And less cars. There aren't the long lines to get into the front gates with all the pickup trucks. And, of course, all of the fast food places, they don't have the lines through the drive-thrus or the crowds that you would see at lunchtime or 7 in the morning when they have to be there earlier. When they have to go into PT, you know, there's always traffic jam on Battalion Avenue or something.
And PT
soldiers
is?
The physical training.
Okay.
That most of the soldiers do at the same time sort of puts a halt on the entire base. And you just start to notice that there are more women and children because you don't have the balance of, you know, the males and the females. Suddenly you just are very aware of the families that are there and they kind of take over. Or you just see them, the kids running and playing, and the wives don't have as much to do in one area of their lives, where they're not worrying about taking care of their husbands as much, so they might have more free time to get together, so you might see them outside.
Now, you write that, of course, that military wives rely on each other for companionship and babysitting and care and empathy, and they don't mix so much with civilians, even though, I mean, there is a town there, Killeen, Texas, and then Austin, which is a pretty hip place, is only 70 miles away. Why is it that they find it hard to kind of mix with civilians?
From my experience, especially in a place like Fort Hood, where so much of the community is military to begin with, you're surrounded by spouses who have so much in common with you that it's just easier to form those friendships instead of maybe the civilian friendships that would include the husband that you suddenly don't have. Or, you know, your soldier's away, so it makes it a little more difficult to hang out with your friends who have their spouse with them, and that reminds you that your spouse isn't there.
Infidelity is one of the things that comes up in here a lot, which isn't surprising because, you know, fears or suspicions of infidelity are part of any long-distance relationship. And, of course, these folks are experiencing long separation with enormous stress. And I thought I would have you read a section from a story, and this was a case of a woman. The character's name here, I believe, is Kaylani. She has not heard from her husband for a while, and so she's so concerned that he hasn't been writing and returning her emails, she decides she's going to find out for herself. Why don't you just read this section and explain what happens?
Sure. So Kaylani sat down at the computer and, convinced it was the only thing she could do, broke into Manny's email. It wasn't hard. He had used the same password for as long as she had known him. Monster Manny. She accessed his account and glanced down the page, seeing her past missives. Are you okay? Javier took 2 steps today. And yesterday's email. Email me ASAP. All the while, feeling something grow behind her lungs. Something that wanted to swallow the air inside of her. Most of the emails had not been open yet, but her husband had definitely been online. A message from one of his high school friends, dated just 2 days before, was no longer in the new mail section. At that point, she ought to have clicked the mouse on the little X in the corner of the screen. She ought to have leaned back in relief, certain he was fine. But she felt the thing in her chest expand, and she continued skimming over the messages that Manny had read. There was one from his brother, a forward from another buddy from home, something she hoped was junk mail advertising pictures of Britney Spears' crotch, and one from a name she didn't recognize, a Michelle C. Rand at usarmy.mil, titled, So Lonely. At usarmy.mil was tacked onto every active duty soldier account as an email address. The mouse hovered, the little arrow pointing at, So. Who was this Michelle Rand, and why was she telling Manny she was lonely? Kailani clicked, open. Manuel, are you coming over Tuesday? My roommate is on duty. We will have the whole night. I want your body so bad. Let me know ASAP. Shell.
And that is how this army wife discovers that her husband appears to be having an affair overseas. So when an army wife discovers something like this, I mean, like anyone who is rocked by this news, there are many things they can do. They can confront their husband by phone or email. They could talk to friends. They could move out. They could talk to their mothers. One thing that army wives can do is report them to the command, and there would be consequences, wouldn't there? Particularly if it was fraternizing with someone else in the military, as this husband seemed to be doing.
And the husband's or the soldier's command would probably have to act, and it could go anywhere, I think, from like an official reprimand that would go into the soldier's record or just, you know, like a non-official talking to the soldiers involved and probably trying to separate them or transfer them to a different unit. That's one of the lines I think that the Army has to walk, is that they are so involved with their soldiers 24 hours a day and they have such control over their lives that something that to the outside world, their civilian world, you know, your boss would have nothing really to do if you're committing adultery. But the Army has to take that very seriously because the repercussions could endanger the lives of soldiers if it's happening during a deployment. And it also could wreak havoc on the social structure at home among the wives. They really need to make sure that the soldiers are as happy as possible, as well as the wives, because it's such a tightly woven community.
So if she reports this to the command structure, other people know, right? I mean, probably other people on the base, probably other people in the soldier's unit. And that's something she has to think about, right?
Exactly.
Do you want to say what this woman did?
In the case of the story, Kailani decides to do nothing. And she approaches the wife of their commanding officer and then decides against telling her.
Right. He returns home. And
yes,
she ends up wanting to confront him, but not doing so. And then she discovers he's having, he's seen horrible things and he's having nightmares at night and chooses to just treat it as an experience that he'd had overseas where a lot of things happened that might be regrettable, but they're going to put it behind them. Do you find this sort of a common way of dealing with it?
Yeah. When the soldiers come home, the spouses want to have a fresh start. And it's a fresh start for both of them because the spouse who's had that long, lonely year, and they know that their spouse is, you know, the soldier has been through an awful lot. And a lot of times the soldiers really don't want to share all of the experiences, obviously, with their spouse. When they're in the war zone, they don't want their spouse to really worry about them and know what they might be going through. And then when they come home, it seems almost like old news, like you're starting over and usually you could be sent to a new base. So it gives this whole feel of a new life starting. And I think it's easier then to almost pretend that the old life no longer exists or has an impact on the return.
You know, there's another interesting kind of take on this. In the opening story of the book, which is called You Know When the Men Are Gone, which is also, of course, the title of your book. And your character meets this woman, Natalia, who is different from other wives on the base. Explain her story, how she's different.
Well, Natalia was someone that her husband had met when he had been deployed previously to Bosnia. So she represents a massive threat to the spouses who are at Fort Hood because she is someone that the soldier actually physically brought back from a deployment to replace the wife he had had. She's everything they fear most about, one, like not knowing what's happening with the soldier who's overseas, and that he might find someone younger and prettier and more stylish and exotic in their eyes. So she starts off as a threat just because of her background of having been the mistress. And then Natalia resists all of the efforts of the wives to become one of them. Like, she doesn't attend the meetings, and she doesn't wash the cars or bake the cookies or do the other things that creates like a cohesive wife community.
In your experience, do military wives talk about these threats of infidelity with each other? I mean, there's a moment in one of the books where someone says, well, there's so-and-so who's a female, abroad in a support role in a unit, and she's a home wrecker. Was there a lot of talk like that?
I think it's definitely a fear, and it was actually one of the positive things about having a soldier in the infantry. And so some of the wives that I knew, we would joke about how lucky we are that there weren't women, and it was one of the only things we didn't have to worry about with our soldiers being deployed. But when you're soldiers away for an entire year, you're going to imagine the worst of everything that could possibly happen. It's just one of the many things that I think spouses would seize upon, and it's something that you could blame another person, you know. And it's something we would fear in ordinary American society. So it's almost easier to imagine than the more horrific things that could happen to your soldier. So I think it was fed because it was part of the common experience versus the situations you wanted to avoid thinking about completely that might happen to a soldier deployed.
We're speaking with Siobhan Fallon. She's written a collection of short stories called You Know When the Men Are Gone. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is Siobhan Fallon. She is a military wife who has written a collection of short stories about the experience. It's called You Know When the Men Are Gone. One story that you write, Camp Liberty, the one that is set in Iraq, you're really following, not a military wife, you're following, a soldier, a sergeant who leads a unit in Iraq. And the descriptions are very detailed and very evocative. I mean, I really feel like I'm in the Humvee with this guy and inside his head. You know, I think I'd like to have you read a piece of your description of this soldier. So this is a section where you're writing about a sergeant, the guy who had been an investment banker. His name is David Mogeson. In his civilian life, he was called David, but in the Army they call him Moog. And you're describing what he experiences after coming back from some time on leave. And he was sort of discontented and his runny nose was running. And this is the description of when he's back with his unit.
His runny nose immediately dried up and he felt alert again, awake at dawn to the call to prayer that reverberated around the base. It was as if his body had grown dependent on the 120-degree days and the 40-degree nights, the long-sleeve camouflage uniform and the heavy lace-up boots, the weight of the helmet and the 40-pound Kevlar vest, the tinny water fed to his mouth by a warm tube from the camelback slung over his shoulder, the churned-out high-calorie but tasteless eggs at the chow hall in the morning, the dried-out MRE bags in the afternoon, sleep-deprived nights of helicopters landing or mortars ringing with the usual bad aim against the perimeter of the base. His body thrived in the desert. His Moog thrived while the weak little David crawled deeper into hibernation. And Moog was seized with a terrible thought. What if, after all of his longing to get out and get on with his life, in his comfortable middle age, he would look back at this time and realize that his years in the Army were the most vivid, the most startling reel of his entire life? Maybe he should not be getting out after all.
And that's Siobhan Fallon from her book of short stories, You Know When the Men Are Gone. You have a lot of photos of Fort Hood on your website, and there's one, mm-hmm. which are really interesting to look at, by the way. I think they add a
Thank
lot
you.
To the story if one wants to read the book. But there's one that you have a picture of a sign at a parking area, and it says, reserved parking for a Gold Star family.
Yes.
Explain that, yeah.
Well, Gold Star is the euphemism for a family who's had a soldier die. It would be one of the parking spots at the very front of, you know, a commissary or PX. And it's kind of a scary reminder. So all of the spot, you know, you drive by and you see, when you go get your groceries and you see that Gold Star spot and you're just praying that you will never have to use it. And then, of course, it refers to other benefits too, like Gold Star families are how we refer to families who have lost a soldier.
Yeah, I have to say it makes, you know, what for a lot of people is, you know, a private kind of pain, very public.
Yeah. Yeah, and that story of mine, Gold Star, that's the issue that the protagonist is dealing with, of whether she ought to take the spot or not, because she knows as soon as she pulls into it, the entire parking lot will immediately know everything, which is almost everything her life has become at that point, with her soldier having recently died. And she has to weigh the importance of what, you know, whether she wants to find a spot on a very busy day at the commissary or keep her grief to herself.
You know, you're right that a military wife really has different lives that they live when, you know, when the soldier is deployed, when the husband's deployed, and when he's not. And in a way, you're busier, too. I mean, you're a single parent. You've got to balance
right.
the checkbook, and if there's a leaky faucet, either fix it or find somebody to fix it and, you know, mm-hmm. change the kids' schedules. And then a year later, the husband comes home. What are some of the adjustments that requires? I
mean, yeah, it's pretty wild. I mean, I know I've been through 3 deployments, and each time I would assume they'd be easier because it's something I've done, but I just have, each time I forget how much I would depend on my husband for these small details in my life that I didn't even realize he was doing, or the things that he would naturally take care of, and then suddenly he was gone and I would have no idea what plumber we used, or I don't know, how to turn off the furnace or turn it back on or reset it, just these things that I can't call him to even find out. So it's definitely a tremendous readjustment when your soldier leaves, and it's almost as big of a readjustment when he returns, because after a year, you've actually finally figured out how to be independent and do everything that you need to do for your child or for yourself, and then your soldier returns, and suddenly you're both have been so independent, and now you need to become dependent on each other. So I think it's natural that there would be a little tension in that situation.
Right, and his head is in some ways still in you know, life-threatening situations he was in, and camaraderie with the unit that was primal.
Right.
One of the interesting things that you write about are pamphlets that the Army gives soldiers on how they should behave when they return. You want to share some of the advice they give?
The Army's really been trying very hard, I think, to handle all sorts of situations. And one of the things they make the soldiers do before they return is they have them fill out all of these surveys to pinpoint problems that they might have and that the soldiers might not even be aware of. And then they return and they all have to go to a certain amount of counseling sessions. And I think that's actually fairly new. Like my husband's most recent return, I remember he had a few days that he had to go to these long, long classes. And of course, you want your husband home. And then suddenly he's got to report into work like the day after he returns. But I see the value in that. I think it's, I mean, we all have that wonderful image of the reunion and we think only that far. We don't really think beyond that.
Yeah, I wanted to share some of the tips in a pamphlet that you write about in the book. These are things a soldier should remember from this Army pamphlet when they come back. No cursing. Your family members are not your men. They are not your squadron or platoon. They do not have to obey your orders. Your wife has been handling finances, disciplining the children during your absence. Don't expect to suddenly walk in and take over. Work with her. Be patient. Tell her you appreciate the job she has done. Take time to be charming. And then this fascinating one, psychologists recommend that you do not engage in intercourse with your wife immediately upon return. Wait a few days until she shows signs of responding to you. Be patient. Good advice?
Yes, I think so. Most of that was actually taken from an Army pamphlet, so that's definitely advice that we're told. And again, it's just something you kind of need to be reminded of when you have expectations that might not be met. And from both points of view, you know, for the spouse as well as the soldier, it's good to know that there's a readjustment stage.
All right. Well, I wish both you and your husband safety and good travels. Siobhan Fallon, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Siobhan Fallon is leaving soon for Jordan, where her husband will be stationed. Her collection of short stories is called You Know When the Men Are Gone. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cabot Creamery Cooperative, five generations of New England and New York farm families working together to produce naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org. And from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
The gritty Australian film Animal Kingdom is about a Melbourne crime family in decline and the matriarch who loves being at the center of a pack of dangerous young men. Coming up, we talk with actress Jackie Weaver, who plays the woman, and with director David Michaud. Also, Ken Tucker reviews The King is Dead, the new album by the Decembrists. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Chances are you missed the film Animal Kingdom in theaters last summer. It's a gritty Australian crime drama written and directed by my guest David Michaud and starring actress Jackie Weaver, who also joins us. Animal Kingdom follows a Melbourne family of bank robbers and drug dealers as the police close in on them. It won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance, and Jackie Weaver's performance earned a Golden Globe nomination. Weaver plays Janine Cody, the mom of the crime family. Stephen Holden of the New York Times called her character a magnetic, seductive hybrid of Lady Macbeth and Ma Barker in the camouflage of a cheery suburban grandmother. Jackie Weaver appeared in the 1975 Peter Weir film Picnic at Hanging Rock and has been a regular of Australian TV, film, theater, and tabloids for decades. Animal Kingdom is the first feature film David Michaud has directed. In this scene, Weaver's character is concerned that a young member of the family may flip and testify against them, and she's leaning on a corrupt cop, played by Justin Rozniak, to have the boy killed in police custody.
Hey, Randall, before you go on, this boy who's currently being looked after, tell me if you agree with this, this boy who's being looked after, he knows who you are. And you know how these things go. They're going to ask him all sorts of questions about everything he's ever seen or done, everyone he's ever met, the whole schmozzle. And you've done some bad things, sweetie, haven't you? I want this part to be clear. This is not about you doing me a favour or me blackmailing you, anything like that. It's just a bad situation for everyone. Ezra's got the address. It shouldn't be too hard to set up a raid on the house. There'd be reasonable grounds, what with all the strange activity, the comings and goings day and night. One of the neighbours might have seen a gun or something. This is your area of expertise. I'm not trying to tell you how to suck eggs. What do you think?
I really don't see how anything can be done, Janine.
Randall, I feel sick about this. I'm not happy at all, not one little bit. But we do what we have to do. We do what we must. Just because we don't want to do something doesn't mean it can't be done.
Well, David Michaud, Jackie Weaver, welcome to Fresh Air. This character, Jackie's character, Janine Cody, or she's called Grandma Smurf at times, right, is such a sweetheart. And there's this amazing touch that we see early on, Jackie, where when you greet your sons and grandsons, all of them criminals, and there are many of them, you give them these nice, slow little kiss on the lips. Tell us about that gesture.
Gesture, though it's a small one, I think speaks volumes about the relationship she has with the boys. Because while it's not indecent or obscene, it is an inappropriate gesture to kiss your adult son lingeringly on the mouth. I have a son in real life who's in his 30s, and I can honestly, and I love him very much, and we're very close, I can honestly say I haven't kissed him on the mouth since he was 2.5 years old. But that was something I wish I could say that was my choice, my acting choice, but it was a little gesture of David's idea. And I think it just said so much in such a small gesture about the strange bond that exists in that criminal family, the power the mother has over them. She has had these sons with different fathers. They were obviously unsatisfactory, probably violent relationships with criminals, and there's also a kind of substitute with her sons, I think, perhaps. This is all surmise on my part. David, who wrote the film, might say I'm talking rubbish.
Yeah, no, David. So good. Yeah, so you've got the grandmother here planting these little kisses on her sons throughout the film. What inspired that?
I wanted just a kind of a small but powerful gesture that represented the almost proprietorial nature of the relationship that this woman has with her sons. You know, that in a way she appears very loving, but actually her relationship with her children is very self-serving. You know, that what she really loves, the idea of being at the center of a pack of quite young and powerful and dangerous men, being her sons, and that's the level on which her love seems to operate. And so I kind of just liked that small and proprietorial gesture. I mean, it's funny, people talk about that, the kissing on the lips, quite a lot, and I actually know I know mothers who kiss their sons on the lips, and so I've been quite surprised at at how effective that gesture has been. I mean, there's another scene in the movie, I don't know if you remember it, but when Ben Mendelsohn's character first appears in the movie, Ben playing Jackie's eldest son, Jackie does that entire scene sitting on Ben's lap, which I actually think is a stranger gesture than the kissing on the lips. I don't know. I don't know mothers who sit on their son's laps.
David Michaud wrote and directed the film Animal Kingdom. Jackie Weaver plays the role of a crime family matriarch. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guests are actress Jackie Weaver and writer-director David Michaud. They both collaborated on the new film Animal Kingdom. You know, this is a film about kind of the daily life of criminals, David Michaud, and it's a pretty unglamorized view of their lives. Were there any kind of crime movie stereotypes you wanted to avoid?
I was very clear when I started that if I was going to make a crime film that I was treading a well-trodden path, and that if I was going to bother doing this at all, there needed to be something about it that was unusual. So it was kind of clear to me that I needed to work out how Animal Kingdom might be different from other crime films. And not because there are a number of crime films that I love to pieces. And I had a clear sense from very early on, based on that first response I had to reading about the central event of Animal Kingdom, that kind of brutal revenge killing of those two young cops, that what I wanted to do was make a kind of sprawling Melbourne crime story that was very menacing, that had running through it, bubbling under the surface, a kind of a sense of fear and threat and impending violence. And then that kind of, in some ways, determined the tone of the film and the way the film should be made, you know, which is that it needed to be a crime film that took itself very seriously, you know, that that couldn't exist in a kind of a heightened or, you know, a light universe. And in some ways that then determined also the, you know, the nature of every decision that kind of stems from that, you know, in discussions that you have with actors and crew about playing things with truth.
Right. Well, you don't see criminals living extravagant lifestyles and spending a lot of money. You don't see them snapping off very funny lines, you know, like you would say in Goodfellas, for example. I mean, these are people who are living under an awful lot of stress.
Yeah. I mean, and they also, I mean, because in a way, what you're looking at, the film Animal Kingdom is a film about a particular crime family in decline. It's in some ways, you know, it's like the third act of Goodfellas in a way as an entire film. You know, it's all of the crime in a way that you see in the film is defensive, backed into a corner, retaliatory crime. It's a film about a gang of armed robbers in which you don't see them committing armed robbery. What you see is them backed into a corner and committing the crime of paranoid retaliation.
Right, and there is a lot of tension in the film. Was there tension on the set? I mean, with all these, as you said, alpha males, you know, contending?
Yeah. It was. I mean, it was fun. There were moments there on set. Yeah, the boys spent a lot of time with each other, and as I think, as Ben Mendelsohn says, they basically got comfortable enough with one another so that they could all start fighting with each other, and which they did, you know. And for me, it was an interesting experience as a director, very often sitting there watching these boys, you know, play rough with each other. Sometimes wondering whether I needed to step in and manage them, but most of the time just sitting there watching them, thinking I'd cast the movie right, you know.
Jackie, there's a knowing giggle from you. What were you thinking of?
Well, I like to think when I was on set, they behaved a bit better.
They did. They did. And I remember actually when we were at Sundance, when finally we got to show the movie to an audience, that feeling, that buzz that started to build around the film was so exciting that you could see the boys who were all there with us were getting very excited too. And that when they get excited, generally stuff gets broken. but so this kind of pack of boys rolling up and down Main Street in Park City at Sundance, creating havoc, was always somehow kept in check by Jackie's presence. You know, you could just sense the way that these boys felt like they needed to behave themselves around her.
So was this like good-natured scuffling? Was it arguments about how to do a scene? What was it?
It was a whole mix of different things. You know, there were, you know, I mean, Ben especially is such a powerful, Ben Mendelsohn is an incredibly powerful actor. He's one of my favorite actors in the world. This is Ben, who plays the eldest brother of the family. And he's so wildly charismatic and entertaining, and has, you know, quite unique ways of eking performances out of his fellow actors that can sometimes involve, you know,
bullying
or just emotional manipulation. And he did it on this movie in Animal Kingdom to great effect.
You know, as you describe Ben Mendelsohn and his bullying and manipulation, I think of a scene in the film where he's sort of getting the emotional upper hand on one of his younger brothers by intimating that he might be gay. This is Darren, right? Played
yes.
by Luke Ford.
Yeah.
Why don't we just listen to some of that scene?
Where'd you get that suit? What's that suit?
It's a suit.
What do you think? It looks good on you.
What?
Looks gay. You gay?
Off, will ya?
It's a serious question. I don't care if you're gay or if you're not gay, you know? It's all right if you are, mate. I just want you to tell me about it, you know? I don't care whether you're gay or you're not gay. I just want you to talk to me about it, you know? You making yourself a drink?
Yep.
What is it?
It's a bourbon and coke.
Bourbon and coke's not a very gay drink, mate. I think, look, if you're a gay man, if you are, and you want to make yourself a gay drink, just go ahead and make yourself a gay drink. You know what I mean? This is what I'm talking about, mate. I just want you to tell me things. You know, it just kills me to see you living a life.
Off. Seriously.
And that's Ben Mendelsohn and Luke Ford in the film Animal King, which was written and directed by my guest, David Michaud. Also with us, Jackie Weaver, who stars in the film. What's going on in that scene where the older brother is you know, suggesting that his younger brother might be gay?
I think it's a clear, and in many ways it's the most crystalline sort of act of emotional manipulation. I mean, Pope, the character that Ben plays, is the most emotionally damaged character in the film, and understands that because this gang, this family, need to exact revenge on the police, that he needs to make sure that his brothers are with him and that they are under his spell. And for him, the easiest way to achieve that with Darren, is the kind of the baby of the family, is to directly challenge his sexuality in the most base way. You know, I mean, to just basically suggest that maybe he's gay is Pope's way of encouraging Darren to man up, you know. And that actually, that day in particular, was the day where Ben and Luke weren't speaking to each other. And it was nerve-wracking, you know, because it felt like an incredibly important scene for me, and it wasn't until we were actually, you know, rehearsing and then shooting the scene on the day that I could see it coming to life. And I could see how that tension, that very real tension that existed between them on that day, was feeding into the scene.
If you're just joining us, our guests are actress Jackie Weaver and writer-director David Michaud. They both collaborated on the new film Animal Kingdom. Jackie Weaver, you know, you were in the Peter Weir film, Picnic at Hanging Rock, and American audiences will remember that. And you've basically, for a long, long time, been doing a lot of film, a lot of TV, and a lot of theater, especially in Australia. Was it ever your ambition to come to Hollywood and make a career here?
I know I've always had fantastic work offered to me at home. I've had a great career. I've done about 100 plays, and I've only done about 15 films. So I've been very lucky. I've played some leading roles in a lot of American plays in Australia that were very successful. So there hasn't really... I didn't really feel coming to America and not getting those leading roles was better than, you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. Well, you know, Jackie Weaver, you've had a colorful life and have fed tabloids for many years. You've had, you know, several eventful marriages and relationships with high-profile men. And it was interesting when I was preparing for this how many people described you as such a delightful interview. And I just wonder, after all of these years, how are you not angry and suspicious of the media?
That's really sweet. Now I am disarmed. You've disarmed me with your charm. One of my favorite husbands was bureau chief for Fairfax Media in New York for 11 years. And previously, I'd had a husband for 5 years who was a journalist. So I do love journalists, if they're good ones. There are some reporters I don't like, and I wouldn't give them the time of day. But no, generally, I briefly for a year on television I worked as an arts journalist on a big current affairs program, and so I had to do interviews myself, and I think that makes you a little more amenable when you're the interviewee if you've had to be an interviewer. So yeah.
Jackie, I have to ask you, is it true that you were fired from a Heinz 57 commercial set for laughing too hard in the shoot?
Well, I was playing an asparagus, Dave, and if you could see me, I'm a very tiny person. I'm under 5 feet tall. Yeah. If it was classic miscasting. I mean, if anything, I should have been the squash. I just found the whole thing so wonderfully amusing in a Monty Python way that I got slightly hysterical, not in a loud way. I'm not a loud person, but I did find it impossible not to laugh all the time. And finally, the producer and the director were furious, and they said that they sent me home. They sacked me, and they rang my agent, said it was the most unprofessional behavior they'd ever seen in an asparagus.
Jackie Weaver, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
No, thank you, Dave.
David Michaud, congratulations on the film, and thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jackie Weaver earned a Golden Globe nomination for her role in Animal Kingdom. David Michaud wrote and directed the film. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new album from the Decemberists. This is Fresh Air. The Decemberists is a Portland, Oregon-based band that formed a decade ago. The band's albums have been characterized by a wide variety of styles, from indie rock minimalism to art rock expansiveness. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the band's new album, The King Is Dead, finds the Decembrists using shorter song forms and guest collaborators such as R.E.M. guitarist Peter Buck. Here's his review.
Had a dream, you and me in the war of the end times. And I believe California succumbed to the fault line. We heaved relief as scores of innocents died. And the Andalusian tribe, setting the lay of Nebraska alight, till all that remains is the arms of the angel.
The Decembrists made their reputation on the strength of group leader Colin Molloy's large, tortured vocabulary and penchant for spinning 10-minute-plus song cycles with influences ranging from Susie and the Banshees to Death Cab for Cutie. Too often, Molloy's use of 19th-century locutions has been pretty cutesy itself. Thus, any attempt by this clever, ambitious man to impose some concision on his music can only be beneficial. This quality is what makes the 10 songs on The King Is Dead cohere as the Decembrists' best album to date, thanks to brisk tunes such as this one called Don't Carry It All.
Here we come to a turning of the season. Witness to the art.
We can assume that the band's album title, The King Is Dead, is a cheerful one. This is, after all, a group that took its name from an uprising, one of whose aims was to abolish monarchy, and which has been known to play the Soviet national anthem to open their shows. But thankfully, there's little garrulous rabble-rousing on The King Is Dead. Instead, Colin Molloy and his band have enlisted singer Gillian Welch and R.E.M. guitarist Peter Buck to help make a record heavily influenced by 70s folk rock, but with fresh riffs, not mere nostalgia. The result is a fine song, such as the album's first single, Down by the Water, featuring both Buck and Welch.
See this ancient river bed, see where all the follies are led. Down by the water, down by the old maiden bed. I was just some towhead teen, feeling round for fingers to get in between. Down by the water, down by the old maiden bed. The season rushed me wrong. The summer swells on. So
there's a song that manages to triumph over self-conscious phrasings such as the summer swells anon and sweet descend this rabble round. Colin Molloy often writes lyrics as though he never quite recovered from a first encounter with the work of Algernon Swinburne. But the guy has a terrific voice, plaintive without being whiny, earnest without being maudlin, coarsened by a fine graininess. Always be skeptical of a fellow who said numerous times that he was heavily influenced by the crown prince of mope rock, Morrissey. But this time around, Malloy is describing The King is Dead as a collection that's, quote, an exercise in restraint. And it's more influenced by R.E.M. and Neil Young. Listening to country and bluegrass music hasn't hurt either, on one of the best songs here called All Arise.
Baby wants a new spin, baby wants a broken heart.
One of the most enjoyable aspects of all of the Decemberists albums is that the band avoids the autobiographical impulse. The band doesn't spill out its memories or its neuroses with either urgency or emo lassitude. Malloy and his colleagues are, at best, real craftspeople who take pride in constructing solid blocks of song, packages that open up to reveal at their sturdiest an interest in and appreciation of the world around them. For that, we can put up with the occasional fussy phrasing or arch alliteration. As Malloy says in one of my favorite lines on this album, which is all the better for sounding so colloquial and tossed off, it's well advised that you follow your own bag. Indeed it is.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed The King is Dead by the Decemberists. And listen to this, the entire album is being streamed online today only at nprmusic.org. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
On a winter Sunday I go to clear away the snow and green the ground below.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at MetLife.org. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, surgeon and journalist Atul Gawande. His article suggesting higher spending on health care doesn't lead to better outcomes caught President Obama's eye a year and a half ago. His latest piece in The New Yorker looks at efforts to drive down costs by providing better care to chronically ill patients. Join us for the next Fresh Air.